From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Sedge Thompson, and this is Fresh Air. Today on Fresh Air, psychiatrist Robert J. Lifton joins us. He studied the psychological effects of the Hiroshima bombing on its survivors, the choices made by Nazi doctors, and the thought control practiced in China during the 1950s. His book, Thought Reform and the Psychology of Totalism, came out in 1961. His ideas are used nowadays by cult deprogrammers and by cult leaders trying to counteract the deprogrammers. Also today, anthropologist Sally Price indicts the practice of Westerners buying and collecting of so-called primitive art. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new collection of old opera recordings. And critic Maureen Corrigan reviews David Lodge's satiric novel about the Catholic Church, Souls and Bodies. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Frank Stacio. The Kremlin today authorized the thousands of Soviet soldiers in the Caucasus to open fire, if necessary, on Armenians and Azerbaijanis fighting in the hills near the disputed territory of Nagorno-Karabakh. Thousands of Armenian refugees poured from the Southern Republic of Azerbaijan, many beaten or chased from their homes by angry mobs. Some blamed the attacks on Azerbaijanis, who earlier fled ethnic violence in Armenia. The death toll rose to 58, the number of injured 169, in 5 days of civil warfare. Top food officials in Romania said today that already short meat supplies have become critical and some communities have imposed short-term rationing. Food shortages were widespread in the last years of Nicolae Ceausescu's 24-year tenure because of forced exports aimed at paying off Romania's multi-billion-dollar foreign debt. Also today, Romanian radio and government officials announced that trials would begin next week for six top aides to Ceausescu. 9 members of the Salvadoran army are expected to be charged before the end of the week for the November murders of 6 Jesuit priests and 2 Salvadoran women. Tom Gibb reports from San Salvador.
A civilian judge has until Friday to bring charges or drop the case. The men under military detention include a colonel and 3 junior officers. One of the 5 other soldiers accused deserted in December. It's still unclear if Colonel Alfredo Benavides was the one who gave the orders. He was head of the military academy and commander of the zone in which the murders occurred. Yesterday, President Alfredo Cristiani said Benavides did order the crime, but military sources say Benavides himself is not accepting full responsibility. If the judge decides there is a case to answer, it'll be the first time so senior an officer has been charged for a human rights abuse. No officer has ever been convicted. For National Public Radio, this is Tom Gibb in San Salvador.
The National Transportation Safety Board released its year-end accident statistics today. NPR's Wendy Kaufman has more.
Major U.S. carriers suffered 24 accidents last year. Of those, 8 involved fatalities. Commuter airlines had 18 accidents, 5 of them fatal. But while the number of fatal accidents rose in 1989, the total accident rates for major airlines and commuters declined. The fatal accident rate for air taxis and private planes was down, and for the 7th straight year, the total accident rate for private planes declined. Overall, the decade of the 1980s showed a decline in accident rates for major U.S. airlines, and notwithstanding the high fatal rates in 1989, the overall fatality rate declined during the decade. This is Wendy Kaufman reporting.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average fell more than 33 points today to close at 26.5913. Declines led advances 4-3. This is NPR News. President Bush said today he still wants the rest of the U.S. invasion troops to withdraw from Panama as soon as possible, but he feels no pressure to get them out before next month's drug summit in Colombia. Bush posed for pictures in the Rose Garden with General Maxwell Thurman, the commander of U.S. forces in Panama, congratulating Thurman and his troops on a successful invasion. Bush said he expects Vice President Dan Quayle soon will visit Panama. West German Chancellor Helmut Kohl today said the post-World War II border with Poland is incontestable. That statement in Paris is the strongest to date on the subject, Deidre Berger reports.
Germany's relations with France and Poland have been strained recently over the refusal of the West German Chancellor to guarantee Germany's border with Poland. Until now, Chancellor Kohl has maintained such a guarantee can only be given when East and West Germany are reunified and sign a peace treaty with the World War II Allied powers. In Paris today, Kohl said Germany will not link the question of reunification to an adjustment of borders. Some conservative forces in West Germany want to leave open the possibility for Germany to regain former territories now part of Poland. Kohl said Germany cannot expect a permanent reconciliation with Poland unless the Poles feel their borders are secure. The West German chancellor emphasized that German reunification can only take place with the approval of all European countries. For National Public Radio, this is Deidre Berger reporting.
U.S. automakers said today Japan's decision to extend a voluntary ceiling on Japanese car exports to the U.S. is not enough. General Motors and Chrysler call it an empty political gesture. Japan announced today in Tokyo that Japan's car exports to the U.S. would be kept under 2.3 million for another year. Japanese automakers pressed for the curbs to be abolished, saying they're no longer needed because exports appear set to fall in the 1989-90 model year. I'm Frank Stachow in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Sedge Thompson, here for Terry Gross, who's on holiday. Psychiatrist Robert J. Lifton's books have explored issues of life and death in concentration camps, mass killings, and mind control. He's written about Nazi doctors, the survivors of Hiroshima, Vietnam veterans, and brainwashing in China. Lifton has said he hopes to draw meaning from the grotesque and unique enormity of evil. Lifton was an early member of Physicians for Social Responsibility, a group opposed to the nuclear arms buildup. He's credited with coining the term psychic numbing to describe the way people avoid dealing with overwhelming threats, such as the possibility of nuclear war. Lifton is a professor of psychiatry at the John Jay College of Criminal Justice and at the City University of New York. He's just revised his book, Thought Reform and the Psychology of Totalism, a study of brainwashing in China, which he wrote in 1961. I asked him why he wanted to revise it after 29 years.
The first thing to say, of course, is that any author likes his books to stay in print. But the truth is that thought reform or thought reform related issues just don't go away. I didn't write the book as an interpretation of the Chinese just at that moment, but rather an interpretation of a whole process, a whole phenomenon, which all too many others were capable of embracing. So I meant it to hold for other things, and now it has particular relevance, I think, in two ways. One is the whole cult phenomenon. Lots of people from cults have come to me in connection with this thought reform work. And the other, of course, has to do with China now and the democracy movement and the government's attempt to reinstate thought reform and a thought reform dominated atmosphere.
I was curious to learn in reading your book that brainwashing is, in fact, a term directly translated from the Chinese.
Yes, right. But the term was originally translated from the Chinese, but from some kind of commentary, some sort of popular commentary. Really, the term the Chinese use is thought reform or ideological remolding. And I discourage the use of the word brainwashing because it doesn't quite mean anything specifically. On the other hand, it captures something, and it's a word that people use widely in English, and it just won't go away.
At what point in China did people stop believing the thought reform? I mean, we've seen radical changes going on in attitudes in China in the past year. At what point does a people no longer make themselves susceptible to thought reform?
One can't really designate a particular point, I don't think. But, you know, even when I did the study back in the mid-50s, it's hardly believable that it was so long ago, I sensed and wrote in my book that the Chinese had over-reformed their population, even from their own self-interest. That is, the government had come in on a wave of glory and had great popularity and energy in applying a thought reform program, but they applied it to a point beyond its usefulness, and a certain number of people were turned off by the exaggerated ideological pressure and the closing of the environment. But sometime much later on, perhaps during the late 60s and early 70s, there really occurred a major change. At that time, of course, the Cultural Revolution was in high gear, and a lot of people were very hurt by the Cultural Revolution, and the thought reform-like methods that were used then were more crude. And in the process, there was a lot of developing skepticism toward ideological programs and certainly thought reform in general. And what one heard or began to hear in the late 70s and early 80s were that they still had these programs, but that people didn't really take them so seriously. They were very casual about it, used them for socializing or for just discussing certain things that concerned them, and the programs didn't have the tautness and power that they had originally.
What would be an example of one of these programs today?
Well, what happened after the democracy movement and the really tragic denouement, really vicious denouement on the part of the regime, was that the regime announced very pointedly that it was going to reinstitute very active ideological remolding, because that's what people needed. So what is taking place now is a kind of re-energizing of the thought reform program, largely at universities, but probably in most places where people work, and in the various small groups that exist throughout the Chinese population. It's hard to say how energetically they're being pursued, because one gets a lot of signals, some of them direct, some of them indirect, and they're what one would expect, namely that people don't believe in the ideological remolding, they don't believe in the claims of the regime, and they don't take seriously the thought reform program.
One can't help but think of parallels of what's going on in Eastern Europe now with some of the ideas of throwing
what's going on in Eastern Europe is very much interrelated in a way that the Chinese regime doesn't want to recognize. For one thing, it's very likely that the events in Eastern Europe were influenced by the democracy movement in China occurring earlier, and now the events in Eastern Europe have had an enormous impact on the Chinese people. And what this tells us, which is very important in terms of evaluating a process like this, is that there is a new phase of world communication. It is no longer possible to isolate a country or a segment of a country in anything like an absolute way.
Well, in fact, part of thought reform, whether it's in a cult or in a political society, depends on isolation. Do you think that thought reform is possible any longer?
Well, it's still possible. You can still try, and it may even have some effectiveness with some people, but it's bound to be considerably less effective for most people. The really principal requirement for thought reform is what I call milieu control, and that simply means the control of communication within an environment. You have to set up a controlling system of communication in order to carry through all the psychological pressures of thought reform. And when that control is very intense, as it could be in thought reform environments in the 50s and during the time that I studied it, then people feel in some way frightened to speak against the going assumptions. And in some degree, the requirements or the position of the environment becomes internalized quickly, so that the control becomes self-imposed, a kind of internal control on the part of the environment, setting up what has been called a God's eye view. And unless you have that degree of control, you simply can't have as effective a thought reform program.
My guest is psychiatrist Robert J. Lifton. He's just revised his 1961 book on brainwashing in China. It's called Thought Reform and the Psychology of Totalism. The religious people seem to hold out most against thought reform, those who had a very established worldview. In particular, in your study, you cite Catholics who held out longest against the thought reform.
Yes, but it's not so simple, as I also tried to suggest. It's true that one could resist much better if one had a strong sense of inner identity, which in turn requires an attachment to some larger set of convictions, and this was certainly true of a number of Catholic priests. On the other hand, there were a tiny number of Catholic priests, one in particular whom I described as having undergone a near conversion to Chinese communist thought reform, because he had a proclivity, a tendency toward what I call ideological totalism, toward all or none belief systems. That was psychologically part of his makeup. And as he said to me, I tend to like to give a blank check toward what I believe in or toward what I'm part of. And he gave that first to the Catholic Church, and then under the pressure and attraction of the Chinese Communist Thought Reform Program, he came to give it to the Chinese Communists. So that situation applies too. The larger principle is that a strong sense of inner identity, belief system, and attachment to alternative principles, all that helps in resisting thought reform.
You're interested in the ideas and strengths of identity. When somebody signs up, gives themselves a blank check for a cult, be it following the Bhagwan or a Jim Jones, what is going on in that dynamic?
Well, identity is very much an issue. But to that, I would add an emphasis that I mentioned then but would give much more stress to now, and that is the life-death situation and the life-death symbolism within which I've been working more in recent years. So to answer your question, a young person who joins a cult may be subjected to thought reform-like pressures, but whatever the circumstances under which he himself experiences a form of self-surrender, if that happens, he then makes an all-or-none commitment to the cult. He forms, in effect, a second self. It's what I have come to call doubling. And something in his life-death parameter, in his psychological economy, has opted for a total commitment to that alternative belief system as a way of living in the world or surviving in the world.
Have you been called in to work as a deprogrammer with people who've been freed from cults?
No, I wouldn't take on that kind of role. What has happened in my work is that people who have been troubled by cult behavior, often the parents of young people caught up in cults or subjected to thought reform-like procedures by cults, have contacted me and consulted with me in connection with this totalistic phenomenon. And indeed, some cults read up on it also because they wanted to claim that they weren't using thought reform or these procedures. But in that way, I was brought into the whole cult issue. And I'm very critical of any sort of group that takes on or takes over a person's psyche to the extent that one no longer is autonomous or thinks freely, so I'm not happy about cult behavior. But as a psychiatrist interested in the phenomenon, working with a young person rather than as either a deprogrammer or as working for any other group.
What have you found in talking with some of these young people? Is there a common thread that you've noticed?
Well, yes, there are common threads, and first, in connection with some of the cult programs, and one has to really identify the particular cult at a particular time in terms of what they're doing in a particular program. But in many cases, there has been a program with very strong parallels to thought reform. Now, sometimes there are very poignant moments with these young people because there is a moral question here, too. I can remember one young person who was brought to me, and I was struck by a kind of conflict in him and a conflict that he evoked in others because he had come from a cult under some duress from his parents. But he also said that the cult made him rather happy because everything was taken care of. He was with a group. He felt very close to people. He didn't have to worry about making any personal arrangements. And his life seemed secure and laid out for him. And I had to ask myself, what is my moral responsibility in a situation like this? And I saw it as, now I didn't like what he had become and I didn't like what the cult was doing, but I saw my responsibility as talking to him and helping him to see what was happening and helping him to be in a position to make his own decision. Unfortunately, he never did reach such a psychological position because something happened between him and his parents, some antagonism, and he fled from his parents, went back to the cult, but ironically, I was told that he was last seen at a bus stop on his way back to the cult holding my book, still struggling with the issue. In any case, that's the kind of poignant moral and psychological situation that can arise.
My guest is Robert J. Lifton. He's a professor of psychiatry at the City University of New York and the John Jay College of Criminal Justice. He's written many books, including studies of Nazi doctors, Vietnam veterans, survivors of Hiroshima, and he's just revised his book on brainwashing. We'll talk more after we take a short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
I'm speaking with Robert J. Lifton. Many of your books have dealt with extremely uncomfortable topics, the way that doctors behaved in concentration camps, going into great detail about their form of practice, the survivors of Hiroshima. You've also talked about the idea of psychic numbing, and I wonder if there's some sort of doubling that goes on with you to help you cope with some of the very raw and brutal material you deal with as a writer.
Well, often people have asked me, how am I able to cope with or constantly immerse myself in a number of rather grotesque subjects, perhaps the work on Nazi doctors, the most grotesque of all. And this is a rather delicate matter. There's no single answer. One answer I quickly give is that I draw comical, amusing bird cartoons. I'm an amateur or not so amateur bird cartoonist. I've actually published two books of bird cartoons. There's a certain truth to that. One needs alternative outlets, but still there is a personal struggle in my work. One does what one feels one can do and one knows how to do, and through a series of steps, I've taken on this kind of issue, and it feels right for me. I learned something very important about my own reactions during the very early stages of my work in Hiroshima. And this was back in 1962 when I was interviewing survivors of that first tragic use of an atomic weapon on a human population. And when I went about Hiroshima talking to people about doing the study, it wasn't so difficult, and they were helpful to me, and I made preparations to do the study. But when I began my systematic, individual, depth psychological interviews, that was another matter, because now I was hearing in great detail some of the really painful, grotesque experiences that survivors had undergone. And I was temporarily there alone. My wife and then infant son hadn't yet moved to Hiroshima from Kyoto, where we had been living, or I was involved in a different study. And I was staying in a small inn while waiting for my family to arrive and beginning the interviews of the study. And I became extremely anxious. In the first few nights, I had difficulty sleeping. I had nightmares. And I really began to wonder whether I would be able to do the study. I knew it was a very important one, but I wondered whether I would be able to see it through. But within a few days, I found that rather quickly, that anxiety diminished. And I found myself much calmer and quite able to take in what was being said to me. Of course, I felt the pain that they expressed, but I was able to look at it in a way that I could ask myself what it represented and think through some of the patterns as a professional who was doing a study of the effects of the atomic bomb in Hiroshima. And of course, I went on and spent 6 months in Hiroshima and did the study. And later on, of course, I thought about this, and I came to see this as what I called selective professional numbing. That is, I had to have a certain degree of detachment from the raw pain of the work in order to be able to do any study at all. On the other hand, I had to retain sufficient sensitivity to the pain of the people I was talking to in order to do a useful and compassionate study. That balance is always a struggle, and it's never perfectly achieved, but that's what one has to strive for. And then, of course, I thought about the whole idea of psychic numbing, because that was very prominent in the people I was interviewing, where it served temporarily as a defense mechanism that they required in order to remain sane. And I thought a lot about psychic numbing in various perpetrators of extreme situations or of massive violence or potential perpetrators, such as the those who make or project the use of nuclear weapons.
My guest is psychiatrist, writer, and teacher Robert J. Lifton. You seem startled that in 1962 nobody had thought about doing a psychological study of the victims of the atomic bombings in Japan.
I was startled by it, and I soon came to a principle, namely that the more important a study is, the less likely people are to do it. I think that a really important study, especially when it's threatening, and it's likely to be when it raises threatening issues, is likely to create pain that the investigator, no less than anybody else, wants to resist. But the second reason might be even more important. Scholars and investigators, thinkers in general, make certain presuppositions or impose certain issues of method or approaches to problems which they don't like to change. And a really fundamental problem or event requires one to question those methods and those assumptions.
There are risks that go along with this. Bruno Bettelheim, for instance, found that in your study on the Nazi doctors, by providing too much understanding, you can run the risk of forgiving people for a particular, you know, heinous act.
Well, there is the risk of that. That is, one can run the risk of replacing moral judgment with a claim of something like clinical insight. Actually, though, I confronted that risk in really embarking on the study and made it very clear that I was holding a moral as well as a psychological perspective, and I use the word evil very centrally in my study. So I felt that having this model that included an ethical and moral judgment, combining it with a psychological one, that simply wasn't true of my study. But certainly that is a risk, and there are others as well.
Do you write with a sense of hope?
I have an enormous sense of hope. My whole body of work is predicated on the idea that by confronting these issues, the human imagination is capable of moving beyond them into more desirable ways. And much that has happened has given, I think, all of us great hope. Hope is not the same as a calculation of optimism or pessimism. Rather, it means that there are possibilities for good things happening in the world and to people, to better ways of behaving, and I think that's where hope lies.
Robert J. Lifton, thank you very much for coming in and being a guest with us on Fresh Air.
Thanks very much.
Robert J. Lifton is a professor of psychiatry at John Jay College of Criminal Justice and at City University of New York. His books include Thought Reform and the Psychology of Totalism, The Nazi Doctors, Indefensible Weapons, and Home from the War. I'm Sedge Thompson, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, my guest will be the physicist Arno Penzias. In 1978, he won the Nobel Prize for his radio astronomy work that supported the Big Bang Theory. His new book, Ideas and Information, is a guide to maneuvering your way through all the new information technology. I hope you can find us and join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Sedge Thompson with Fresh Air. Today, anthropologist Sally Price tells us about the hidden patronizing, arrogance, and racism that lurk beneath our Western desire to own art from the Third World. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new collection of works by Caruso and other opera greats from the early part of this century. And critic and Catholic high school graduate Maureen Corrigan reviews Souls and Bodies, its novelist David Lodge's satire of Catholicism. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
For National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. In spite of civilian blockades at airports and highways, thousands of Soviet troops moved into parts of Azerbaijan today, 2 days after the government ordered a state of emergency, in an ethnic conflict that has left dozens of people dead. NPR's Ann Cooper reports.
The government said its troops are authorized to fire on attackers in self-defense or to protect military stockpiles in the southern Soviet Republic. Looters have ransacked dozens of police stations and military posts, making off with arms and ammunition used in guerrilla-style warfare. Some 11,000 Army and Interior Ministry troops began their mission to restore peace in the most troubled regions today. But Soviet media reports indicated that tensions remain high and armed conflicts continue. In the Azerbaijani capital of Baku, where rioters brutally attacked the city's Armenian population this week, thousands of Armenians abandoned their homes, fleeing to safety in the neighboring Republic of Armenia or to other parts of the Soviet Union. For National Public Radio, I'm Ann Cooper in Moscow.
1 year ago today, a young drifter named Patrick Edward Purdy opened fire with an AK-47 assault rifle on a crowded schoolyard in Stockton, California. He killed 5 children and wounded 30 others and a teacher. Today, gun control advocates marked the anniversary of that tragedy by lobbying for new legislation. NPR's Ina Jaffe has more.
After the Stockton shooting, California became the first and so far the only state to outlaw sale and ownership of military-style weapons, like the one used by Patrick Purdy. Today, California State Attorney General John Vandekamp held a news conference in support of legislation that would impose a 15-day waiting period for the purchase of all rifles and shotguns.
It would require a background check on anyone who purchases a gun, and it would disqualify criminals and the mentally ill from owning and purchasing firearms.
Legislation to restrict the ownership of assault weapons was reintroduced in the New York State Legislature today. And in Washington, Janet Gang, the Stockton school teacher who was wounded, called for a nationwide ban on assault-style weapons at a news conference held by a gun control group and the National Education Association. Her request to meet with President Bush was denied. I'm Ina Jaffe reporting.
In Washington, the National Transportation Safety Board said today that U.S. airlines had 11 fatal crashes last year, the most recorded by the agency in 21 years. The board said that 278 people were killed last year in flights by scheduled and non-scheduled U.S. air carriers. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials closed down almost 34 points to close at 2,659. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. Nimbus Records has a new series of operatic recordings made during the first half of the century. It's called Prima Voce. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz says the CD set has good sound and great performances.
There's a charming scene from a pretty terrible MGM movie called Two Sisters from Boston, starring Catherine Grayson and June Allison, in which the great Wagnerian tenor Lauritz Melchior is in a recording studio early in this century. He's singing into a large horn. An engineer kneeling at his feet pushes him away from the horn on the powerful high notes and pulls him closer for the pianissimos. When Melchior stops singing, a group of violin players rushes forward to the horn. That's probably very close to the way early vocal records were made. When we hear old recordings by the opera stars of that era, we usually have to listen with what Coleridge called a willing suspension of disbelief. Sometimes it's hard to know what the singers actually sounded like. Modern equipment has been making it possible to play back more and more of the information that lies beneath the surface noise of the old shellacs. Now Nimbus has released a remarkable series of ancient recordings that are a sonic revelation. Here's what Caruso really must have sounded like in 1907. Nimbus has come up with a fascinating new approach. They found old operatic recordings in nearly mint condition and have recorded them without modern filters from the very best horn gramophone. Instead of a modern stylus, they use freshly sharpened thorn needles. The recording is made in a small concert hall with a single, so-called ambisonic microphone, the opposite of the multiple microphone technique that makes so many modern recordings sound so antiseptic and unnatural. There's actually very little surface noise in Nimbus's Prima Voce series, and there's an appealing atmosphere around the voices. The orchestral accompaniment is still pretty tinny, but each voice has a real presence, an individual identity, both in the phrasing and in the actual vocal timbre. I've never heard a modern transfer quite like it. It's hard to choose only one or two examples when there are too many even to list. Anyway, here's one of my favorites, Spanish mezzo-soprano Conchita Supervia singing the Habanera from Carmen on a recording made in 1930. Not even Callas was more teasingly seductive or more sexually threatening. Supervia died in childbirth in 1936 at the age of 41. Nimbus has issued 5 installments in this remarkable series so far. There are albums devoted to Caruso, to the great American soprano Rosa Poncel, and to the Italian tenor Giovanni Martinelli. And there are 2 sampler albums, Divas 1906 to 1935 and Great Singers 1909 to 1938. The Supervia selection is on the Great Singers disc. I think it's the first of her recordings to be issued on CD. Nimbus is planning to release an average of 2 new discs a month over the next 2 years. I can't wait. Let's close with La Vergine degli Angeli from Verdi's La Forza del Destino. The great soloists are Poncel and the Italian bass and matinee idol Ezio Pinza. Can you imagine a more enchanted evening of opera?
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music critic for the Boston Phoenix. He reviewed the new Prima Voce series on the Nimbus label. This is Fresh Air. Introduction to her new book, Primitive Art in Civilized Places, anthropologist Sally Price describes her book as being about how, quote, objects from around the world have been discovered, seized, commoditized, stripped of their social ties, redefined in new settings, and reconceptualized to fit into the economic, cultural, political, and ideological needs of people from distant societies, end quote. Those distant societies she refers to are those inhabited by educated Westerners or people who fancy themselves as art connoisseurs. Throughout her work as an anthropologist, she's studied cultural life amongst Andalusian cork and olive growers, Caribbean fishermen, and Mayan corn farmers. I asked her why she turned her ethnographic skills in the more rarefied world of art dealers and collectors.
Well, I guess the first thing to say is that the whole notion of primitive art is a Western construct. That is, there is no such thing as primitive art. There's no unity in the arts of people in the Northwest Coast and Oceania and Africa and the Suriname rainforest. There's nothing that unifies those arts except in the Western perception of things.
You explain about the issue of anonymity, that for a lot of collectors, the fact that an art object is anonymous is part of the excitement, the seductiveness of it. And you quote a Parisian collector as saying, once you learn who made an object, it ceases to be primitive art. What's going on there? Why is the anonymity so important?
It's part of the more general dehumanization, I think, of the artist behind primitive art. When you look at museum collections that have labels underneath the objects, it's much more common to find the name of a collector under the object than the artist himself or herself. And that's not because we can't discover the names of these people. They are available if we went out and looked for them in many cases. But there's a kind of appropriation of primitive art that ends up making us the authors of the aesthetic that's being represented. Collectors often talk to me about how their collection, the aesthetic behind their collection, was their own. It was not something that the original artist intended. The artist was crafting an object, not designing an object, and working according to age-old traditions and so on. And it was the collector who really selected and therefore became the author of the aesthetic element in that collection.
It sounds like you're saying the collector then sees her or himself as the artist.
In a sense, that's true. If we think about cultural authority, and we're talking in many cases about people who consider themselves authorities on so-called primitive art, the word authority is very related to the word authorship, and there's a tendency for a sleight of hand there, a little slippage that allows people, in a sense, to see themselves as the creators of this art, not in the sense of making particular pieces, but in allowing their aesthetic vision to define the beauty of these things. And for that, of course, the original artist must be anonymous.
Your book includes some chronicles of collecting from the 1930s, which take Indiana Jones two or three egregious steps beyond.
people actually going into to cultures and stealing items, slipping sacred flutes into their boots, objects, you know, into umbrellas, in order to sort of steal them away. Is this still going on? Do you still see this going on around the world?
Yes. The example that I quoted in extenso in the book was from the 1930s, simply because it was a case that was written up, I thought, extremely well by a French anthropologist named Michel Leiris, who described very openly and I think very well the kinds of tactics that he used traveling across Africa. But the practices that he described are certainly not over. They are less frequently talked about and less eloquently talked about now, but the kinds of things that he described happen all the time in all parts of the world now.
Have you seen any contemporary theft going on in the course of your field work?
Yes, I have.
How does that take place? What do you see?
And that's something that I think I'd rather not include in this interview, except to say that it is very pervasive.
How do objects get from the field into one of those apartment houses along Park Avenue that somehow look like bank safe deposit boxes?
You know, well, they rarely come directly from the field into a collection. What happens, as it was explained to me by dealers, principally in Paris, was that when an object comes in from the field, directly from, let's say, someplace in Africa, it has relatively little value, and it's traded around in a network. And as it passes from dealer to dealer or collector to collector, it acquires what I have described as the pedigree, and its value increases as it makes the rounds of different named collectors. And so that's an important process in establishing its value, and it finally comes to rest in some collection with a much higher value than when it came into the system, simply because of having passed through the hands of people who are known to have a discerning eye.
You reproduce a number of ads in the book, how we view primitive sort of base, untrammeled-like ideas of perhaps so-called primitive people with sexuality. There are also ads reproduced from the American Museum of Natural History, a poster of one of their exhibits of arts from the Suriname rainforest, and there's what looks like something that might be a quilt or a painting. And the copy above it says, "If we didn't tell you it came from the Suriname rainforest, you'd think it was modern art." What were you hoping to illustrate with that?
Well, this occurs in the chapter of the book that's devoted to my own experience in presenting the arts of the Suriname Maroons in the United States. And that ad is the second stage of an experience that began with the poster for the exhibit, which also featured that same textile. The exhibit was co-curated with my husband, Richard Price, who is also an anthropologist. We had chosen that textile as the object that we wanted featured on the poster, and the reaction by a public relations person who was dealing with the poster was, "This isn't primitive art. This looks like modern art. This is not what we want. Is a fetish, or we want some kind of little statue, something that looks like primitive art." And our point in insisting on using that textile was that primitive art comes in many different shapes and sizes. People in other cultures make all kinds of things, and that's why we insisted on that textile. And what happened was that the textile was used for the poster, and by the time the exhibit arrived in New York, what happened was that perceived incongruity was picked up on by another public relations person who used it for its shock value. I mean, this doesn't look like primitive art. This is shocking to us. This is not our traditional notion of primitive art, and so it was used in that sense in a positive way for public relations. But in both cases, the idea was, this is not our notion of what primitive art should look like, but in fact, it is one of many examples of what primitive art does look like.
How do you view the art of the Maroons when you're in Suriname yourself? What has made the difference for you? What has made you sort of come to accept it as a as an art that has a context of a people? Has it been learning their language? Has that been what's the critical issue for you?
Well, certainly we did learn their language. We lived with the Maroons for about 3 years and came to understand that not only art, but also aesthetic thinking was very important to them. People talked about art a lot, and there was awareness, aesthetic awareness of what they were doing with their arts. And there was also a very clear art historical consciousness, and that's another area where people have very distinct ideas, very fixed ideas about Western art versus non-Western art. And the received wisdom is that people outside of our own traditions, or what Joseph Alsop called the great traditions, I think he has a list of five or six, that these people have no sense of art history, that that's very special to our more advanced civilizations. And in Suriname, we found that people were very aware of different periods, what we would call art historical periods, different styles. They were named styles for different generations going back, and we were able to delineate a very clear art history and pick up on a very strong art historical consciousness in this society.
Well, Sally Price, I want to thank you very much for coming in and talking with us on Fresh Air today.
It's been my pleasure.
Anthropologist Sally Price is a visiting professor at Stanford University and the author of Primitive Art in Civilized Places. It's published by the University of Chicago Press. This is Fresh Air. Coming up later today here on National Public Radio is All Things Considered, and co-host Noah Adams has stopped by to give us a preview. Hello, Noah.
Hi there. On our program tonight, troops in the Soviet Union have been given permission to fire on Azerbaijanis and Armenians to protect their own lives in the Soviet Union. We'll also have our second report on the AIDS epidemic in Uganda. Tonight, the problem of AIDS orphans in that country. We'll talk with a man who has modeled for cigarette advertising for Winston Cigarettes. He was a smoker at that time, 3.5 packs a day. Now he's campaigning against smoking. He's had a mild stroke, and he wants to make sure that young people don't start. Also, a new Fats Waller musical retrospective.
Thanks for the preview, Noah. All that coming up later today here on National Public Radio. David Lodge is a British novelist well known for writing farces about life in academia, including Nice Work and Small World. He's a professor himself at the University of Birmingham. In 1980, Lodge wrote a novel exploring another fold of his own experience, Catholicism. That book, Souls and Bodies, has just been reissued in paperback. For critic Maureen Corrigan, the novel sparked these thoughts.
I went to Catholic grammar school, high school, and college, and by the end, my belief in mortal sin, limbo, and virgin birth was wearing pretty thin. And of course, there was the sexism. But the last straw came during my senior year in college. I went to a friend's wedding at a church called Our Lady of the Skies near Kennedy Airport. Instead of the usual crucifix above the altar, there was a giant silver statue of the Virgin Mary standing on a propeller whose blades were positioned in the shape of a cross. That was it for me. I just wasn't going to genuflect to a propeller. Since then, I haven't been inside many churches, but when I'm asked my religion on emergency medical forms, I always put Catholic. Maybe I retain some core of faith. Or maybe, as David Lodge writes, I'm one of those cowards who, when reminded of death, falls back on religion as my insurance policy, and Catholicism in particular, because it offers the most comprehensive coverage. In Souls and Bodies, Lodge lampoons the Catholic Church, which he finds every bit as absurd as the intellectual priesthood of academia. As always, Lodge writes with the knowledge and empathy of an insider. Like Evelyn Waugh, another great Catholic satirist, Lodge goes beyond the jokes to consider why some people remain Catholics, even while they question whether the Shroud of Turin might just be a slipcover and the Pope just another politician. Lodge's novel begins in 1952, when his characters are still undergraduates at a Catholic university in London, and it follows their lives over the next two decades. There's virtuous Angela and gloomy Ruth, who's prime nun material. Also Miles, who's tormented by the church's condemnation of homosexuality, and Father Brierley, the chaplain who avoids thinking about the dogma he preaches and women. As Dennis, another member of the group, explains, the more you examine something like the changing of bread and wine into Christ's body and blood, the more bizarre it seems. Dennis wonders, at what point does the miracle of transubstantiation reverse itself, since it cannot be that Christ submits to the indignities of human digestion? Is it as the host begins to dissolve on the tongue, or as it travels down the esophagus, that Christ jumps from his wheaten vehicle and into your soul? Though I came of age after Vatican II, hair-splitting questions like these were still the staple of my theology classes. Lodge is also brilliant at unraveling church logic, especially the baffling 1968 encyclical on human life that reaffirmed the ban on birth control and drove away hordes of young Catholics. Lodge finally understands belief in Catholicism by comparing it to the leap of faith that readers take when they enter a novel. He writes, "We all like to believe, if only in stories. People who find religious belief absurd are often upset if a novelist breaks the illusion of reality he's created." That makes sense to me. We all probably find ways to preserve our necessary fictions and only dissect the ones we think we can live without.
Maureen Corrigan teaches at Georgetown University. She reviewed Souls and Bodies by David Lodge. It's published by Penguin Books. Amy Sallet and Phyllis Myers produce the interviews on Fresh Air. Sue Spolin does our research. I'm Sedge Thompson.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Nobel Prize-winning scientist Dr. Arno Penzias joins us. He's at the forefront of technological development and a proponent of science geared to the needs of society. We also meet actor and director W.H. Macy. For years, he's worked with playwright David Mamet, and now Macy is directing the professional premiere of a Mamet play. That and more next time on Fresh Air.